In the wake of last week's violent riot at the U.S. Capitol building, a lot of different aspects of the things that have developed in the wake of that, one of which, one among very many, is the reaction of social media outlets like Twitter and Facebook to Donald Trump, most notably, but a number of the other people who were involved in the riots and also who encouraged the demonstrators in advance. Twitter, most notably, suspending Donald Trump permanently from that site. And that has raised a number of questions and also some confusion and misinformation as well. So all that we can do to clear it up here will do. David Ardia is a UNC law professor and also the co-director of the UNC Center for Media Law and Policy. And he joins us on the phone. David, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Aaron.
So, first of all, just before we get into details, it's been a crazy week and a lot has happened. What are your thoughts in general about all of this? What did you see that stood out to you, and what did it make you think of?
Well, it's really dizzying in the speed with which these decisions are being made. It's almost like the dam is broken in a number of social media companies that were sort of sitting on the fence, feeling great pressure to act, all of a sudden felt the constraints were off, and we've just seen the dominoes falling at a remarkable rate. Really an incredible week in terms of the country's perceptions of these events, and very much likely to see long-term impacts that are going to stretch for years, if not decades, in terms of our approach to social media platforms in the public sphere.
Were you surprised by the way that Twitter and Facebook and all these other sites reacted?
Well, I think there's, as I mentioned, there's been a lot of pressure on these sites to crack down on President Trump, particularly because it's been clear that much of the speech that he engages in has violated their terms of service, and yet they've allowed him to continue to use those services. Meanwhile, many others who don't have the same profile that he have been banned or suspended. So I don't think it's a surprise that that they're doing this. It's a bit surprising, however, the speed with which this is happening and how consistently, or I would say how quickly the dominoes have been falling, how many other companies have done so in a short period of time. I do think that as we think about this, it's very easy to be supportive of platforms that, or the deplatforming of speakers that we don't like. What this forces us to face is a question when it is speech that we support and the speaker is deplatformed. How are we going to feel in that situation?
Yeah, and I think kind of the starting point for me thinking about all of this is, well, one of the common negative reactions that we're hearing from the right is that, well, what Twitter and Facebook are doing is unconstitutional. It's a First Amendment violation. Well, it's not a First Amendment violation because the Constitution only limits the government, but Twitter and Facebook are very large and powerful actors, and government isn't the only agent that can have a negative effect on individual freedom in general and speech in particular. So what if anything, are the legal responsibilities of sites like Twitter and Facebook to protect and police speech, and what is the moral and ethical responsibility too? Because that's a whole separate question.
Well, absolutely, and I think that you have to start with this basic understanding that the First Amendment really is not relevant in the actions of these private entities. We have a very clear line that demarcates constitutional protections as applying only to government and not to private entities. So when we throw around the First Amendment, when we say this is a First Amendment violation, it isn't actually a First Amendment issue. It is, however, a broader issue of the power of private entities to shape the public sphere. And, we've seen with the rise of the Internet a shift from public discourse occurring in public places, in government-owned spaces, on the streets and sidewalks and public parks, to these electronic fora, that are not publicly owned. They're owned by private entities. And and so as more and more public discourse is happening in these walled gardens, in these places that are owned and controlled entirely by private entities, we are able to speak only with the permission of those entities. And that really points to the power they have to shape public discourse. So when we think about what obligations from a legal standpoint Twitter or Facebook has with regard to its users, they can create obligations through their terms of service. They can also give themselves the power to do almost anything in terms of removing and banning speakers. And when you look at their terms of service, they have done that. So their ability to remove President Trump and other speakers and other types of speech from their services is entirely consistent with their terms of service. So there really is very little legal recourse. There's no legal recourse really for those speakers to complain and go to the courts and get any kind of a right to speak on those platforms. And in fact, if the government or the courts were to require some Twitter or Facebook to keep up this kind of speech, the platforms themselves would have a First Amendment right in that situation not to let the speech of others be on their services. With Supreme Court precedent that says that you can't force someone to allow another speaker to use their services. In that case, it was a newspaper. But the platforms themselves have a First Amendment right against government compulsion. So what we're left with is a set of sort of norm-based, moral-based arguments that these platforms should treat everyone fairly, that they should provide a diversity of viewpoints, but they aren't legally required to do that. Now, one of the things that we're seeing playing out quickly this week is the fact that the alternative channels that may have been in existence, Parler, mm-hmm. Other sites that were more willing to allow this kind of speech to take place on their platforms, have been struggling to maintain their services because they are utilizing a small number of other technology service providers, such as Amazon's cloud-based services, that have been kicking them off of their services as well. So rather than having a number of different choices that the public has access to, if one service bans some types of speech, they can go somewhere else. Because we have a highly consolidated media ecosystem in terms of social media, there's really only a very small number of very powerful players. Those alternatives are becoming constrained as well.
Speaking with David Ardia, UNC law professor, and everything you say is sparking 10 questions in me, and I've got 1,000, and our time is limited. This is one of those conversations where I want to keep talking with you forever, but we're running short on time already. I do want to ask about the speech in question here, specifically, and we can keep coming back to Trump in particular, since he's kind of at the center of all of this. Is the speech that we're talking about, is this even considered First Amendment protected speech at all? There are exceptions to the First Amendment freedom of speech. There are things where the government is or has the authority to step in and restrict people from speaking publicly in a particular way. Does this reach that threshold? I mean, we're talking about potentially inciting an insurrection. Like, if the government were to step in and shut this down, would they be within their authority?
Well, you'd have to look at specific instances of speech and make that determination. To paint with a very broad brush, I mean, obviously a great deal of the speech that's being taken down doesn't even come close to meeting the legal definition of incitement.
Mm-hmm.
But as it begins to get closer to, and so the definition is speech that is advocating imminent lawless action, and that's a very high standard, and it's very context dependent. So there may be instances where some of the speech does meet that definition, and the government would be able to punish that speech. But certainly that's not the case with regard to the vast majority of this speech, and it's questionable whether the context on social media, that sort of abstraction, necessarily abstracted from the physical proximity to the recipient of the speech, to the physical proximity to the engagement of lawless action, that, you know, the sort of, as we move further from the acts themselves, it becomes more and more difficult to show that it does meet that definition. And what we have here are platforms that have policies that don't rely on the speech being criminal, that don't rely on the speech violating any laws. As long as they violate the policies of the platform itself can create definitions that are broader than what the law imposes. And they're free to do so because, as I mentioned earlier, the First Amendment doesn't prohibit the platforms from banning and suspending accounts that violate their own terms of service.
Where do you see us going from here?
Well, I think, you know, I think what we're going to see is this speech going elsewhere. And that's part of the thing to be thinking about, is just because you ban someone from saying something doesn't mean they're still not thinking about those thoughts. It doesn't mean they're still not speaking to others about those thoughts. And what we're seeing is a lot of the speech going further underground. It's becoming harder to track. It's becoming more splintered. It isn't like, well, we just wave our magic wand and all of a sudden half of the country that supported Trump changes their views because they're no longer able to express those views on Facebook and Twitter. That's not the case at all. They feel just as strongly today as they did a week ago, maybe even more strongly, because they feel like their views are being oppressed. And they're going elsewhere to have those conversations. And so that organizing is still happening. It's becoming harder for law enforcement to track. It's becoming harder for researchers to follow. And so I think we're going to see splintering of these groups, but we're not likely to see in the short term that speech go away. It's just going to happen elsewhere, where it may in fact be more difficult for us to get a warning that they're planning protests and potentially violent events, and that can be a problem.
Speaking with David Ardia, and as we wrap up, anything else that we haven't touched on that's particularly important for people to keep in mind through this?
Well, you know, the line between violence, the line between speech that creates and leads to violence, and the type of speech that is necessary for the releasing of steam and tension within society, that line is very blurry. We need to give people a chance to be able to vent, because we know from history, if they don't feel like they have a voice, then they turn to other forms of protest. Often that then leads to violence. So we need to find a way to balance the societal need to be heard. At the same time, we need to be able to obviously protect our institutions, protect individuals, protect our democracy from the kind of violence we've seen this past week. So we're struggling to find that right balance, and that balance has proven to be even more difficult to find in the age of social media.
David Ardia, UNC School of Law, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Aaron. Thank you.